This will be taken under advisement. Next case for argument, United States v. Sutton and others. Mr. Singleton.
Good morning. May it please the court. James Fleming challenged the imposition of consecutive three strikes sentences. And subject to the questions of the court, I think the brief adequately addressed that issue. I just wanted to point out that for reasons that are not clear to me, I referred to the current version of the statute rather than the 97 edition, which would have been effective at the time of the offense conduct. There have been some changes in structure and in the language used, but I don't think that they affect the arguments as submitted by Mr. Fleming. With respect to issues in the consolidated brief of the parties, after the U.S. Supreme Court denied cert in Mr. McFarland's Fifth Circuit case, I would have to term that issue as dead in the water. I still think there's some merit in it, but I have to concede there's no federal court in the country that agrees with me on that. The final issue here is the district court's exclusion of fingerprint evidence. Now, the basis for that decision was that the defense hadn't designated an expert witness. It's Mr. Fleming's position that an expert wasn't needed. We cited U.S. v. Hatchett on that proposition. And Hatchett was more of an authentication case. And this court quoted the treatises for the fact that sometimes if you try to admit a public record under 803.8, that a foundation witness often isn't needed. Well, that wasn't the issue here. I mean, the report's authentication wasn't raised. I was somewhat caught flat-footed by the district court's ruling that an expert witness was needed to present the defense case, which was very straightforward. Fingerprints were, fingerprints were examined, analyzed, no match was effective. This is not what I would respectfully submit a Rule 702 situation where an expert testimony would assist the jury in understanding the evidence. That fingerprints can be analyzed and compared has been in common knowledge since for over 100 years. Mark Twain incorporated as a major component of the plot in Pudd'nhead Wilson and referred to it again in Life in the Mississippi.
Does Mark Twain qualify as an expert under Daubert?
I think he'd qualify as a layman who apparently understood the subject matter and submitted it for the edification and enjoyment of lay audiences, including myself. I would.
Of course, Twain was also famous for beginning his novels with the declaration that any relation between the content of this novel and what an intelligent man would know was strictly accidental.
As well as anyone seeking to find a moral in it would be shot.
Yep.
I would respectfully submit that the district court's reliance on Hatchett was an erroneous exercise of discretion. The record shows that she didn't really seem to read what was in that case. She referred to it as a handwriting case. She referred to it as standing for the proposition that without an expert, you couldn't submit this kind of evidence. I think that is actually it baffled me. But the ruling baffled me. But the reliance on Hatchett for these propositions is bewildering. I mean, these crime lab reports that were self-authenticating. They were non-hearsay. They're obviously relevant. I don't think they required any expert for their admission. The government has come back with this is harmless error. And I will concede, actually, I will finish briefly, that I can't tell that there would be a different result. But I do think that it affected Mr. Fleming's right to present a defense. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Singleton. Mr. Summers? Okay.
Thank you, and if it would please the court. In regards to the issue of severance between my client and the Mr. Singleton's client, James Fleming, I think for the most part it's been covered in the briefs, and unless there are any questions at this time, I guess I will save all my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hanifan?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brent Hanifan. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Robert Sutton. Due to the short time I have, I simply wanted to discuss our position as to why it was error for the district court not to sever Mr. Sutton's trial from the trial of Mr. Fleming and Mr. Brown, and why the admission of the confessions of those co-defendants was error under the Bruton Doctrine. First, it was error under the Bruton Doctrine because the confessions did not sufficiently redact all reference to Mr. Sutton. The confession by Mr. Fleming repeatedly referred to another individual who participated in the crimes with him and the Madison individual who planned the crimes. Now, throughout the prosecution's case, from its opening statement through the testimony of the witnesses and the closing arguments.
Suppose we agree with you about this. Does anything really turn on it? It covers only one of the 11 robberies. Why isn't it harmless?
Well, it was, as the prosecution discussed over and over, this was the big one. This was the robbery of $50,000, the robbery of the Great Midwest Savings and Loan. Certainly, it added 20 years to my client's sentence when he was convicted of that. It also goes to show further conspiracy between the defendant.
20 years? I thought he was sentenced to life.
No. I believe my...
Sutton?
Yes.
Oh, Sutton is not the one who had the...
No. He received... And the 20 years I'm referring to is the additional sentence due to the conviction under the 924C count, where he received 5, 20, and then 20 for the three counts. So it does matter a great deal, even though it's only one particular crime. The reason, discussing briefly why, if in fact you agree with that, that it should not have been referred to as the other individual or the Madison individual, the reason why it's not harmless goes to the fact that the government, throughout its case, talked about the jury need to rely upon the detailed confessions. Mr. Fleming was the only person who was able to testify as to what exactly happened during the robbery of Big Mike Subs and the robbery of the Great Midwest Bank. Every other witness was someone who was either outside of those crimes or heard testimony from other witnesses following these crimes. This is testimony that would not have been presented at Mr. Sutton's trial had he been tried alone. And so for that reason alone, that is why I believe it is not harmless. If I may suggest a rule in terms of what the government could have done if it still refused to sever the trial of Mr. Sutton from the trial of Mr. Fleming and Mr. Brown, that is to omit the references to the other names of the witnesses in the statement by Mr. Fleming. The fact is that he referred to several other witnesses, several other individuals by their name. The only two that were not referred to specifically by name were the Madison individual who planned it, which was clearly Mr. Brown, and the other individual who committed the robberies. So if, in fact, this court were to find that it's permissible to use the term other individual or Madison individual, I believe at least going forward, it should be clear that prosecution should not be allowed to introduce the names of other witnesses, because it then becomes so easy for the jury to look up and discern who those other individuals are in the confession. Unless this court has any questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanifan.
Thank you.
Mr. Stewart?
Good morning. Stephen Sinnott on behalf of the United States, and I also represented the United States at the trial, along with my colleague, John Beaudry. I'd like to deal with the fingerprint evidence and the issue regarding the introduction and evidence of the redacted statement of co-defendant Fleming.
Let me just ask you about these consecutive life sentences.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who is that?
That's the defendant Fleming.
Fleming. What is the difference between consecutive life sentences and concurrent life sentences?
Functionally, no difference at all.
Well, but functionally, should it be reviewable? That is to say, if there's no challenge to the propriety of making them concurrent, Is there any possible reason for wanting to consider whether they should have been consecutive? Why is that even justiciable, since it couldn't make any difference, right?
Without very dramatic changes in medical technology.
That's a good point, Your Honor. It is the functional equivalent. I believe that the argument was phrased in terms of cruel and unusual punishment, but that's not the case at all.
It just doesn't mean anything. You have to have finite terms for consecutiveness.
Well, it does have some, although it's functionally the same, I think it does have, legally, there could be a challenge to one or more of those convictions
defendant. But that's why the point is, if it's conceded that they're okay as concurrent sentences, right, then that means that if you knock out one, you've got the other concurrent. So what difference does it make whether you knock out one of the consecutives or one of the concurrents, if it's an infinite term in either case?
I agree. Practically speaking, functionally speaking, there's no difference at all.
Is there an element of absurdity about the situation?
I wouldn't call it absurd, Your Honor. I wouldn't, because it
sounds absurd, right?
It's like the classic Texas sentence of two death sentences followed by life imprisonment followed by 300 years.
Well, Although it makes no difference, I wouldn't call it absurd. It's not an absurd result.
Well, on this Bruton claim, now, if Sutton has a good Bruton argument, is there actually any other evidence that he had a gun?
That he had a gun?
Yeah.
Mr. Sutton, there's plenty of evidence in the record regarding his possession of weapons. That he had guns in connection with several of these robberies.
But Mr. Hanafan said that his 20-year 924C comes out from just the use of a weapon in that great, whatever that store was.
Yes, in connection with the Great Midwest robbery.
Great Midwest, right.
He was convicted of both the substantive bank robbery and a 924C that was dependent on the finding of guilt on the bank robbery.
And that 924C was responsible for an extra 20 years?
Correct.
Okay. And so what is the evidence of his having had used a gun in that robbery?
Well, in that particular robbery, the only direct evidence of possession of the gun, first of all, there was the tellers who saw the robbers with the gun. There was the testimony of Melissa Kwame, who testified that while in a car with the defendant Sutton, she saw a gun that appeared to fit the description of the gun that was used in the robberies, that he fired it out the window. And then subsequently, the actual gun that was introduced in evidence at trial was recovered from defendant Sutton in connection with another robbery, not one charged in this case, but one in Milwaukee County. And the testimony was that gun was consistent with the gun used in the robbery. So while there was no direct evidence of Mr. Sutton having a gun in that robbery, there certainly was plenty of circumstantial evidence that could lead a reasonable jury to conclude that he had the gun. Now, regarding the Bruton issue, I'd like to stress a couple of things. First of all, the procedure that we followed in this case is that procedure which was recognized by the Supreme Court in Gray versus Maryland as the way to go in these cases. We're the ones. The prosecution filed the pretrial motion for an hearing in which we proposed certain redactions. We received that hearing. The defense made certain suggested changes. We adopted most of the changes. The court adopted most of the changes that were suggested. And then at trial, we presented the oral testimony of the detective. And we were careful to show the jury no indication of a redaction and to substitute the names of the defendants with the neutral pronouns of another person, another individual, that sort of thing. Mr. Hanafan mentioned that the government harped at trial about the confession. That's not the case. The arguments regarding the confession were very narrow, mentioned briefly in opening only as to defendant Fleming, mentioned briefly in closing only as to defendant Fleming. And there was, of course, a limiting instruction by the district court instructing the jury to consider it only as Defendant Fleming. Now, this procedure is exactly the procedure recognized by the Supreme Court in Gray and also recognized by this circuit in Stockheimer. This is not the situation.
How is this consistent with Gray? Can you explain that in detail?
Well, actually, in Gray, the Supreme Court actually gave an example of the type of redaction that would be appropriate. Instead of Stacy and blank, or deleted, beat the guy, the Supreme Court suggested Stacy and a few other guys. That kind of neutral description. And that's exactly what we did here. And it's similar to what was done in Stockheimer, and not at all like what was done in Hoover. In Hoover, the named defendant, Hoover, was, of course, the leader of the gangster disciples, and he was referred to in the redacted confession. Instead of a neutral pronoun, prosecution used the phrase incarcerated leader, which this court held to be the functional equivalent of an alias. And actually, they used the example of Mark Twain and Samuel Clemens to bring it full circle. That's not the case here. There was not anything like that in this case. This, as I pointed out, this is much more like Stockheimer and not at all like Hoover. If I could turn then to the fingerprint issue, I'd like to put it in context. Again, as to this issue, like many of the issues raised pre-trial, it was raised by the government in a motion in limine before the trial. And we asked the court to preclude any evidence regarding the fingerprint evidence. And of course, the government had produced to the defense in discovery all of the reports of fingerprint analysis that had been done at the various crime scenes. There was no incriminating evidence recovered at any of the crime scenes regarding fingerprints. We anticipated that the defense might try to do what they in fact wanted to do in this case, and that is seek a trial to introduce the report and only the report. And while I have great respect for my colleagues in the defense bar, particularly in this case, I have to say that that is a ploy. And what it is, it's an attempt to present the jury with a very narrow issue, just the piece of paper that says these fingerprints were compared and were not the defendant. Now, if Judge Crabb had allowed that to go forward, what would have happened is we would have had to call an expert who would have testified that it doesn't mean that the alleged robbers didn't touch the items, and it doesn't mean that a lot of other people didn't touch them, that there's all sorts of reasons why fingerprints don't show up. It would have caused a lot of time and a lot of confusion. And that's why Judge Crabb properly excluded it, not just because no expert was called, but also because under Rule 403, the very minimal probative value of such evidence was outweighed by the prejudice and confusion that would have resulted. I think this is a perfect example of a district court properly exercising her discretion, her gatekeeping function, to keep from the jury evidence that really has no bearing on the issues before the court. And on both of these issues, both the Bruton issue and the fingerprint issue, I'd like to emphasize the harmless error argument. The fact of the matter is, this was a 6-day trial involving more than 40 witnesses. We had no less than 5 of the young girls who were getaway drivers. We had an inside man on one of the robberies, the movie gallery robbery.
Who is Caldwell?
Victor Caldwell was one of the defendant's fellow robbers. He testified as well, along with James Moss, who was yet another robber. Now, the arguments of the defense in their brief really are arguments not properly made to this reviewing court, but were properly made to the jury and properly rejected by the jury.
I'd like to go back to Fleming's confession for a minute. Wasn't there, did the redaction benefit Brown in any way because of all these references to his after-hours club?
Those references, I submit, did not hurt Brown, nor did they identify Brown. Virtually everyone involved in this case hung out at Brown's After Hours Club. The fact that the meetings, the planning sessions for these robberies took place at that club in no way identified Mr. Brown as the person named only by neutral pronoun in the confession. In fact, the evidence was that Mr. Fleming himself was a bouncer who worked at the club. So the fact that he was holding these meetings in the office of the club in no way implicated Mr. Brown or anyone else. If there are no further questions, then.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stennis. Mr. Singleton?
Thank you, Your Honor.
A few points on the fingerprint evidence. The record is clear that the decision wasn't based on Rule 403.
Could you raise your voice just a little?
Certainly, thank you. The record is clear that the court's decision wasn't based on Rule 403. It was on the failure to designate expert witness. The government concedes that, or appeared to concede, that an expert would have been required for their case. The defense case was very straightforward. The harmless error argument is not particularly persuasive. It's easy to say it wouldn't have made any difference, but we really were unable to compile a full record of what the testimony on this would have been as far as what the investigators would have said, as far as what the event witnesses would have said. We're left with the reports which are in the appendix. I see that my time is up. I don't want to get into my
counsel. Okay, thank you, Mr. Singleton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Summers?
Okay, please, the court. In regards to the redacted statement, actually, I think it's absurd to claim that it did not identify Brown. There are three reasons. Number one, the testimony at the trial was Kim Fitzgibbons was the girlfriend of Brown. In the statement, they said that this other man showed up with Kim Fitzgibbons. That could have only been Brown. So basically, they were saying the man who was the boyfriend of Kim Fitzgibbons, Brown. Two, in regards to the After Hours Club, it was testified to that these meetings took place in the office of the After Hours Club. Brown ran the After Hours Club. Therefore, it's absurd to say that doesn't implicate Brown. If he's the owner of the club, obviously he controls the office of the club. Number three, even the trial court said when they ordered the redacted statements to be allowed, they said that the government could not refer to the gun. When the officer testified, he referred to the gun. Even the trial court said at the time that would be unfair and that would implicate Brown. So even by the standard of the redacted statements, what occurred at trial violated that. In regards to the harmless error, to say that this wasn't harmless, again, I'd put forth is equally absurd. Actually, the government has given the best explanation to explain why Brown knew all these details. Everybody hung out at his club. Everybody drank at his club, and the testimony to it is they smoked pot at his club. All that took place. The fact of the matter was every single witness used by the government in this case was a dirty witness. Every single witness that had anything to say about Brown was a dirty witness in a big way. It was someone who had been involved, a dirty witness. And when I mean dirty, I'm...
Before they came to court?
Well, no, actually, I mean something a lot worse than that. I mean, basically, they were bribed almost, and all practical purposes, for the testimony. Every single one had been involved in these crimes. They were caught red-handed. Every single one of them was given a fantastic deal to say that Brown was involved. And in almost every single case, in their original story, they said Brown wasn't involved. After they lied, and in almost every single case, they lied in front of a grand jury, then the government made their deals with them. And all of them got fantastic deals if they changed the story after already lying under oath and now saying, well, guess what? Brown was involved too. And the fact, and to say that didn't have any bearing, that had tremendous bearing. That's why Fleming was such a damaging witness, because Fleming was the only one, basically, to the jury's eyes that didn't get anything to implicate Brown. And so when the jury would be able to match up his statements with the testimony of the other witnesses, one being Kelly Fitzgibbons, and two being the office area of the club, and three being the gun, they were basically able to say, he's talking about Brown, and he didn't get a deal. So what he says must be true. And of course, and I see that my time is running out, but the bottom line, I'll say, it is not harmless error, it's not even close.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. Mr. Hannafin?
I just wanted to raise again the point of why the Bruton rule exists. The Supreme Court said in Bruton that the reason that the court limited what could be in evidence from the confession of a non-testifying co-defendant is because those confessions are powerfully incriminating against the other defendants. So for counsel, for the government to say that it was not important, that it didn't matter to have this testimony come in from Mr. Fleming, is simply not the case.
Well, Mr. Sinnott argued that the other evidence against Sutton was overwhelming.
I disagree. Certainly there was evidence and there was testimony by other witnesses. However, in the closing argument, what counsel said was the testimony of Mr. Fleming corroborates the detailed confession of Mr. Fleming corroborates the testimony of Jill Phillips. They were trying to have Mr. Fleming put his imprint of the insider knowledge on the testimony of all the other witnesses and bolster that testimony. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And all three of you were appointed, were you not?
Yes.
Well, we thank you for accepting the appointment and for your efforts on behalf of the court.
And for reminding me to go reread Pudd'nhead Wilson.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both sides, and we'll move